work here at IIED in the Human Settlements Group, which is one of the four research groups at IIED. And my main task is just to welcome you this evening. It's really good to see this sort of turnout. At IIED, we're very... we often feel this room, this space, is an underused resource. It's a really nice sort of size and venue for both having enough people to have a lively discussion, but not too many people that it feels like a vast event. So I'm really pleased that we've got the right sort of turnout for what promises to be a really interesting discussion. The topic for the afternoon is on urban health. It's something where we have great staff resources at IIED, people with long and less long levels of experience of working on the topic. It's a topic where we have fantastic partners, and very much of this evening is going to be driven by the work that is being done by people and organisations who we value greatly and who we've worked with for a long time. And it's also a topic of great importance and relevance, and presumably that's why you're here, because you think that as well. But we think that for all sorts of current and emerging reasons to do with the situations in low-income and informal settlements in cities in the Global South, to do with demographic change, to do with climate change, it's a topic that warrants more attention than it has, and where we're really excited to be able to help to facilitate some of that discussion. So we had a really good, smaller, focused meeting around developing some more specific research plans this afternoon. One of the things that really struck me was how interdisciplinary our discussion was. I think I counted that we had engineers, medical doctors, anthropologists, geographers,
Epidemiologists,
I can't even say that. So a really interdisciplinary set of people to address a really interdisciplinary problem, which continues this evening. So I have very little to say on it. I hand over to Alice, who's going to be coordinating the panel. My only other role is to try and keep up the Twitter feed going from this evening. So there's the IIED Twitter handle and the hashtag that we will use. So please do follow and share on social media. And please do join us afterwards for some extremely serious networking with just a tiny bit of drinking and eating on the side as well. Thank you very much and welcome.
Thanks for me as well. I'm Alice Fridlich. I'm a researcher working with David and David at the Human Settlements Group here, and it's my pleasure to introduce our three panelists tonight. I'll start with Siddharth Agarwal, who's joining us from India. Dr. Agarwal is a physician by training with extensive research and programming experience in community empowerment, public health, and health policy. He's the director of the Urban Health Resource Center, an Indian nonprofit organization working to foster health and well-being in partnership with local communities and with government officials. UHRC played a key role in the development of the Government of India's National Urban Health Mission, and Dr. Agarwal has previously advised the World Health Organization and has served on the executive board of the International Society for Urban Health, including as its president from 2010 to 2011. He also serves as adjunct faculty at the Schools of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University and at George Washington University. Finally, he's published and lectured widely on urban health inequalities, different aspects of vulnerability, and related policy concerns. And selfishly speaking, we are getting to work with him on a new project. We're very thrilled to have him with us. Next, we have Shari Kovacs, who's associate professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, or LSHTM. For over 20 years, Shari has researched the effects of weather, climate, and climate change on human health. She joined LSHTM back in 1994 to work on one of the first comprehensive books on climate change and health, and she holds a PhD in epidemiology as well as social policy, master's in social policy. She's currently directing the NIHR Health Protection Research Unit in Environmental Change and Health, partnering with Public Health England, the Met Office, University of Exeter, and UCL. She was the co-coordinating lead author for Chapter 23 on Europe for the IPCC's last assessment in 2014, and she co-authored the evidence review of the UK's second climate change risk assessment for people and built environment in 2016. Thank you, Shari. And last but definitely not least is David Satterthwaite, who's worked as senior fellow at the Human Settlements Institute, Human Settlements Group at IID since 1994. He's collaborated closely with institutions in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, mainly on urban poverty, health, environment, and urban development. He's particularly interested in what causes and underpins vulnerabilities of low-income groups to environmental hazards, including extreme weather events. He served as the co-coordinating lead author for Chapter 8 on urban areas at the last IPCC assessment. He serves as visiting professor at UCL's Development Planning Unit and previously received the Baldwin Environmental Prize. He's in another hat that he wears, he's the editor of Environment and Urbanization. We have some issues back there if you're interested. So thank you, David. And I think David will kick us off.
Editors always bring their issues with them.
When I started working in the Human Settlements Group in 1977, the Argentinian who was the founder of the program had a lot of curiosity. He was an architect, he was a planner, he was a historian. But he said, David, why do we know so little about the health in informal or illegal settlements? You can look at this informal settlement, you could guess to see similar informal settlements in pretty much every port around the global south. And the impossibility of providing pipe water, of sewers, of drains, the difficulties of providing health care, emergency services, is obvious as you look at it. This is Nick from David Odman, who opened this. Very often
the people living here don't access their state entitlements, their right to put their children to school, to healthcare, to policing, to the rule of law, because they lack a legal address. Without a legal address, these resident entitlements just get forgotten. You can imagine the threat of eviction, how common flooding is. They're not using those... they're not that high for no reason. It's just an illustration of how much the water level rises and falls. But if you ask, what are the main health problems in pretty much every informal settlement I've been in, and no one's quite sure. Is it that people assume that health issues are more serious in rural areas, so they haven't looked at the urban data? There's many studies showing that urban health issues are not necessarily less serious than rural areas. Is it government attitudes? Those in informal settlements are illegal, and therefore they don't deserve public services, and they don't deserve data collection about them to serve those public services. Is it weak and underfunded urban governments? In much of Africa and Asia, I come across city governments with almost no investment capacity. Or perhaps it's the aggregate statistics that are obscuring the health conditions in informal settlements. We get so many aggregate statistics. This is Sao Paulo. You can imagine that aggregate statistics would aggregate the informal settlement on the left and the formal, rather beautiful sky high-rise on the right. Now, to aggregate health statistics for those two makes no sense. It means you lose the detail that you need for a decent policy. Urban areas really ought to be much healthier than rural areas because you've got so many urban advantages in urban economies of scale or urban economies of proximity. You concentrate people, you concentrate enterprises, and it's much cheaper to provide them with sewers, storm drains, roads, healthcare, emergency services. We got lots of good examples, mainly from Latin America, of cities that have really invested using economies of scale and proximity. Many Latin American cities have 100% of their population access to pipe water, to sewers, to drains, to healthcare, to emergency services. And that's been a local government transformation of the last 10 to 20 years. But if you concentrate people and all their wastes without the water, the sanitation, the drainage, the healthcare, the schools, you get some of the most dangerous living environments in the world. Again, why is there so little data on health in informal settlements? Because our data gathering systems are largely designed to serve national governments and to give them national averages. The demographic and health surveys are a fantastically rich and detailed and deep new source, well, not so new anymore, source of information about health. But they can't tell you about the health in informal settlements. They can't tell you about the health in particular localities. These are national sample surveys, which aren't, well, are not enough interviews to be able to say what's happening in a particular informal settlement. Censuses should be collecting relevant data on health determinants in every lane, in every ward, in every district. That data should be collected, but it's almost never returned to the ward officer or the district politician or the municipal mayor in a form that they can use. Census data is kept aggregated. Now, in Latin America, this has changed. You'll see census authorities delivering census data to community organizations, to local governments, to serve in the identification of housing and health problems. But it's rare for that to happen in much of sub-Saharan Africa or Asia. Vital registration data, absolutely critical for driving health reforms in 19th century and early 20th century Europe and North America. Knowledge about what were the causes of death and where were those people located and their age. But in most of the cities I work in, there's no vital registration data. Or if there is, it only covers very small parts. It would never cover informal settlements. Generally, hospital and healthcare records are a goldmine for analysing patterns of particular diseases, their spatial location. But again, in most of the cities I work in Africa and Asia, no one is using hospital records as a basis for improving our knowledge of health. The African Population and Health Research Centre, as one of its first major research programmes, decided to look in detail at how health problems in informal settlements in Nairobi differed from health problems outside the informal settlements. And so if you just look at the first three lines, Nairobi looks to be performing pretty well in infant mortality rates. Rural areas look much more serious. Other urban areas are still below rural. But if you actually look at informal settlements in Nairobi, and half of Nairobi lives in informal settlements, you get a completely different picture. Kibera, so well known as one of the largest informal settlements, with infant mortality rate over 100. Embakasi, a smaller informal settlement towards the airport, 160. Embakasi's under 5 mortality rate is 250. One child in 4 is dying before their 5th birthday in Embakasi. Now, that doesn't strike me as an urban advantage. For the other issues, how do we assess risk? If we have no data on risk, how do we make judgments? How do we suggest what the most serious risks are? Go to Dar es Salaam and you ask many people what the most serious risks are, and they'll say floods. And floods are very serious. And In many years, they killed more than 100 people. This was a picture of a flood in 2014 that had 10 deaths reported. Here's a low-income part of Dar es Salaam in 2012, 30-plus deaths and 5,000 forced from their homes. And of course, floods have enormous impacts over and above deaths in injuries and illnesses, in loss of assets, in loss of homes, in loss of livelihoods. So clearly, risk within Dar es Salaam, floods are an important part of risk, especially for particular areas. Okay, remember, roughly 100 deaths per year from floods in Dar es Salaam, but over 8,000 die from HIV, AIDS and TB. 5,000 are dying of pneumonia and influenza, mainly infants and young children from respiratory infections. Malaria is killing over 3,000, diarrheal disease. Somehow, these don't enter the discourse on risk. So in the absence of data, people look at physical hazards as the main risks. As they have no data on diarrheal diseases or acute respiratory infections or dengue or malaria, those don't get included in this idea of risk. Interestingly, how would this change? This is causes of death across the whole population. How would it change if this focused only on informal settlements? Of course, we suspect that it's the infectious and parasitic diseases would rise to even more prominence in the total health care. it's been very difficult to get the people working on housing and living conditions to work on health issues. Years ago, I was chatting to the head of research at UN Habitat, and I said, why aren't you driving a positive health agenda for informal settlements? He said, no, that's WHO's task. Mm-hmm. 6 months later, I was at WHO working with them on urban health, and I said, why don't you give more attention to urban health? Oh, that's UN Habitat's task. So UN agencies are simply not recognising the incredible importance of a health agenda within non-health issues. Water, sanitation, drainage, healthcare, schools, the rule of law. So in conclusion, we know very little about health problems. We know very little about the priorities of those that live in informal settlements. Without the data, how can we begin to act effectively? How can we generate relevant data in informal settlements? Can vital registration systems be quickly and easily rehabilitated so they actually function and serve their public purpose? The most amazing source of health data that I've come across in my entire professional career is the surveys and mapping done in informal settlements by grassroots organisations, mostly by women's savings groups that federate and then have this capacity to do very detailed profiles of every informal settlement. They do very careful mapping, they use GPS devices. What they're generating is an incredible database on determinants of health, with some material on health, on particular health issues. Do go and see this amazing site, Know Your City. The federations of slum dwellers, the federations of shack dwellers that work in these 32 nations have done these detailed profiles of informal settlements in 7,000 informal settlements in 470 cities. This is filling all the data that census data doesn't, that the demographic health surveys don't. It's very locally specific. And it's also the people who are suffering the deficiencies who are defining the problem, who are owning the data. And what we've seen time and time again is that with these very detailed data sets, local government becomes interested. They have something that the local government wants. So, for instance, this is an example of the sort of publication they produce, which is profiles of every informal settlement in Harare. And there's another two pages to complete the complete list of these informal settlements. And what these profiles are doing is looking at each of these informal settlements and engaging in dialogue and discussion with the inhabitants. How does water work? How does sanitation work? They have the same detail as the demographic and health surveys, but they're done for every settlement. And they're done for every settlement in a community process where everyone contributes, and you can then generate consensus on what the priorities are. And, you know, they create very detailed... another time, if you want more detail on this, we got hundreds of examples of these very detailed, careful maps done by community organisations to provide the basis for upgrading. This is for upgrading an informal settlement in Epworth outside Harare. Okay, that's it.
Sorry, we'll definitely have time for questions at the end. Yeah, well, I've got a very different perspective because I'm coming from the health side. Can I just ask, has anyone here come from a health background? Great. Okay. So hopefully I kind of just... My aim is to just give a broad overview of how climate change affects health. You're not very... familiar with the topic. The climate change is a huge area. You know, it affects nearly every disease. If you think about how diseases are seasonal, if you think how uncomfortable hot weather is if you're not used to it at the moment. So I'm not going to be able to give a comprehensive overview of all the way that climate and weather and rainfall interact with human risk. But I think it's important to separate out that there's a kind of range of questions that we have for climate change and health. And I'm an epidemiologist, so I sit firmly down here as well, because we're still very interested on kind of primary effects of high temperatures, weather and rainfall and heat waves and floods on health of populations now. So you'd think we'd actually have quite a strong evidence base here, but we don't so much. I mean, we've done quite a lot of research in the UK. So, for example, this hot weather, we know that death rates are going to go up, you know, not massively, but enough to make, you know, a concern, and enough that the government institutes health prevention measures. So we have a heatwave plan in the UK. We don't know much about flooding. Even in a data-rich country like the UK, we cannot link people's flood exposures to their routine health data. So we can't use hospital admissions and we can't use mortality without going through some very complicated processes. But we have done a survey of people, for example, who got flooded in the UK a few years ago, and we've been analysing that data. So some of these key questions are difficult to do in the UK. So they are extremely difficult to answer, given the lack of data that we have for poor urban or even just general urban populations in low and middle income countries, because they don't have the data that we need. And then we want to use those data that are good, where we're confident that there is a risk, so we can quantify the burden. So as David was showing, those kind of causes, we really need to know where the burdens are, which is what we call it. So basically the number of deaths or the number of DALIs, because we want to look at morbidity as well. So it's not just about dying or dying early, it's about lifelong disability, lifelong disruption and impairment. And you quantify that in an indicator called a DALI. And then you can compare across risks and hopefully invest your healthcare money and your non-healthcare money appropriately. So we do want to do the burden of risks. And we want to assess the burden of climate change, because governments do need to know that, and it's an argument for mitigation. But if we also could quantify from the impact of floods, then we could quantify the impact of heat waves, that again would incentivize local governments or local communities to implement prevention areas. And then we also have these very high level questions about climate change, you know, reasons for concern, the questions about global inequalities, where the vulnerabilities across the world are, you know, and where are the real risks of really horrible, you know, catastrophic things happening. So although your climate modellers who sit in the Met Office will give you oodles and oodles of climate data into the next century and beyond, what we don't have is lots of quality projections for future populations, because we need to know where people are. So this is actually slum data, or the proportion of urban residents living in slum. It's data from WHO. They've been telling me that it's out of date now. But clearly, the trend of urbanisation and slum populations is a key trend if we're looking at future risks, and we are being asked to quantify these risks for climate change in 20 years and 50 years. And until we have a robust, I mean, I know you can't predict the future, but we really need a better idea of what these kind of scenarios are, of where people are and where vulnerable people are. Because the slum populations lack the infrastructure, and they are in places that give them higher exposures to things like flooding. I mean, we know that they're on coasts, they're on riverbanks, they're on hillsides, vulnerable to landslides. So even if there was no climate change, these populations in high-risk areas will increase the burden of extreme weather, right? So this may be familiar. It's climate change, obviously, has to mediate through local changes in the local environment. You know, you could probably, the heat wave we're having at the moment, some part of that is due to anthropogenic climate change. We're going to get a lot more heat waves like this in the future. And then you can have, they call it, more direct effects from heat waves and floods, like I've said, but also kind of indirect effects on the infrastructure, which will then have knock-on effects for health, particularly loss of power services, loss of transport services, loss of hospitals destroyed by flooding. Then there's more kind of wider concerns that are much more uncertain about, issues around security, issues potentially conflict, that's quite controversial, that one. And then changes to the local ecology, so a lot of concern about vectors, changes in vector-borne diseases, and so on. And then we would categorise these as your health effects, so changes in infectious disease, particularly food and waterborne disease. And then a key one will be actually around food, so whether there's enough food for everybody, given population growth and some concerns about plants or crop yields, particularly in low and middle income countries in the future. So as I've said, we have a kind of emerging evidence base about increases in temperature, but this is a very complicated area because higher temperatures will not just affect people directly, they'll affect their risk of mortality, and we kind of have an idea of why people might die during heat waves. Obviously, people will die from heat stroke if they're exercising outdoors, so we're worried about informal workers or daily wage earners, rickshaw drivers, people on construction sites, farm workers, they're at risk of dying of heat stroke. And we know people at home who are quite elderly or quite vulnerable and have chronic diseases, they may be at risk of dying, or their risk of dying on a very hot day is also increased. And also children are, and babies are very vulnerable to heat stroke as well. But it has other effects. It affects local air pollution levels, and it will also affect infectious disease dynamics because bacteria and vectors are obviously sensitive to temperature, they're cold-blooded, so it can have all sorts of effects that are quite difficult to disentangle. And the same with increases and decreases in rainfall. So the one thing we know about climate change is it may increase or decrease your annual rainfall, and there's quite a lot of uncertainty about the rainfall projections, but we know that it's going to intensify. So you're going to get more rainfall with more days with very heavy rainfall. And that, of course, increases the risk of local flooding and surface water flooding and so on. There's also drought. So drought is becoming a real problem. Cape Town have just experienced a major drought that disrupted their services and caused huge amounts of problems. And apparently London is the most drought risk city in Europe, or the second most drought risk city in Europe, and they've put in contingency plans for drought. They're doing a lot of drought risk planning. So yes, so drought is definitely a concern. And obviously cyclones and hurricanes, you know, extreme storms, they have catastrophic effects. So just a very quick summary about heat risks. I don't know, this is data from Cape Town. So Cape Town has good data, and this data does include the informal settlement populations. And so basically for most countries, if you take daily deaths and you kind of fit a model, so it's temperature along the bottom, you end up with a U-shaped relationship, and that's true everywhere. Obviously the slopes change and the thresholds change. So this point where the heat risk goes up is higher in warmer countries, warmer cities, and lower. So in Oslo it's around 16, in London it's 23, in Bangkok it's late 20s. So populations adapt to their heat risk. So the interesting impact here is children. So obviously there's a heat risk, that shows that death rates go up in the aged 14, not to 14 year olds, and you also see it in the elderly. But there's not much going on in the adults, which is what you would expect. And then on the left, because people understand these heat risks kind of relatively well now, there's a lot of focus around how do you prevent heat deaths? You know, how do you help people? What advice do you give? Do you have to provide water? Do you provide cooling shelters? What sort of warnings do you need? There's a lot of research around that. And so most countries in Europe have a very well-developed heat action plan, and that's now being spread to other countries. So there are a couple of cities in India, and Pakistan is also now developing heat action plans as well. But they need to be evaluated, so we need to make sure that all the money that does, they're not very expensive things to implement, that they are effective and that they make sure they're reaching the people that they need to reach. So one of the main modifiers of risk is, of course, housing, and low quality housing interacts with these climate risks. It's clearly important whether your house is in a flood risk zone, whether it has flood protection. There are lots of things you can do to your house to stop water coming in, for example. And then a characteristic of informal settlements, of course, is low quality housing, and particularly if you have cardboard or corrugated iron, steel roofs, they heat up and cool down, so you've got no protection from the temperature extremes at all. And this is about the only study I found where they've interviewed people and got kind of direct qualitative evidence of the link between poor quality housing and exposure to high temperatures as well. But of course, if it's really hot, then you're not going to stay in your house, and so you would go somewhere, presumably. There's a lot of research done now on the impacts of hurricanes. So this was Typhoon Haiyan. So clearly there's a lot of focus around the mortality risk, But we know that flooding and extreme events have long-term issues on mental health now, and this can carry on for years and years after the event. So even the work research we've done in the UK has shown that high levels of mental illness, so mostly anxiety and depression, 2 years after being exposed to a flood, because it's seen that it's a very traumatic event. And in low-income countries, you obviously have other concerns around infectious diseases and vector diseases and malaria as well. Leptospirosis, I should say. So this was another bit of modelling we did, because there's groups that will model global flood risk. There's a kind of set of coast. This is from a coastal flood model, but there are also river flood models. And so there's a kind of demand to do a lot of global health estimates for climate change, which is actually very hard to do because you have to make a huge amount of assumptions about future populations, future health status, future vulnerability, and that sort of thing. But this is basically based on data from disasters. So it's a kind of third type of data set. There are some disaster data sets, and this one's called MDAT, and they collect data on individual disasters and they record the number of deaths. And some of this is from the newspapers, so it's not the best source of data, but it's the only source of data. And the scale along the bottom is development, it's the HDI, human development indicator, and you can see clearly that mortality gets worse as countries develop, because they've got increased development, and it's entirely due to the increased exposure of an increased population in a flood risk zone. And then things gradually improve as countries improve their warnings and measures, like Bangladesh has improved their their tropical cyclone prevention, has reduced the mortality of impact of hurricanes and typhoons or tropical cyclones in Bangladesh quite significantly. But ideally, we'd want this not just for mortality, but all the other health risks associated with it, and then you'd have a more rounded development, or a more rounded and comprehensive impact, idea of the impact of that event. Okay, just one more comment, and this is about prevention, climate change prevention. So there's a lot of effort at the moment looking at air pollution. Air pollution is still the number one environmental health hazard, so globally. It's the number one within WHO, it's number one in the UK government. And as you can see, it is a huge problem. There are many low and middle income cities which have extremely high PM concentrations. And this is not just transport, it's to do with household fuel. So this is indoor air pollution and then indoor and outdoor, because the division, you know, people can cook out. So household energy can cause outdoor air pollution because of where they cook, okay? So there's a lot to be done. If you could give people clean energy, you could obviously have a huge health benefit and improve the environment at the same time, and also improve or lower greenhouse gas reduction. So this is just an example. This is actually from Beijing, which obviously had extremely high levels of air pollution. And so there's a lot of focus now on costing these co-benefits of particular strategies. So this is looking at a major strategy or a Chinese policy to improve household energy. And you can see that they did improve levels. This is in years of life lost, but they haven't quite hit their target. So that's a cause for optimism, I think, that there's going to be a huge amount of investment into clean energy and try and reduce some of these environmental hazards. That's what I was going to say. Thank you.
Somebody just needs to help. There is a man.
I don't know why I was looking before.
Is it there?
Just turned out.
Where is it? This one?
Yes.
If you put it to small screen.
Oh, that
Oh, okay. Thanks very much, David. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here this evening. So this would be, this, what I will share is largely from India, and it would have more pictures, and feel free to jot any questions that you have so that we can have some conversation. This is how the presentation is organized. These are pictures of informal settlement dwellers who contribute low-cost labor for the cities to grow economically. So all cities, including developed countries, grow because they find low-cost labor. This is the environment in the informal settlements. This picture shows a toilet outflow and two creatures just below that. And this picture is from Indore, which is in the center of India. This is the effect of climate change, the heavy downpour which Hari talked about, and the water has entered the house, as you can see. And this leads to damage of important documents like picture ID, proof of address, date of birth certificate, and income certificate, all those which are important for their well-being. And this gives you a broader picture of the different dimensions and determinants of well-being of the urban informal settlement dwellers. Now, why is it important to invest in the informal settlements? The less healthy and less nourished workforce is not going to contribute as well to the urban economy as a better nourished workforce will. In most developing countries, the economy is becoming more and more urban. So a better nourished workforce would be good. It would be good for the politicians to make still more brighter statements about their countries. And also pathogens thrive in the suboptimal environments that you just saw. The urban component of GDP of most developing countries is growing fast. The last point is also important, that most funders consider it unsafe to have a project where there are too many unknowns. But when we are talking about people who lead their lives at risks, there will be more unknowns. You cannot predict all the outcomes of a project or a research. So that is an aspect which needs to be focused on. Some experiences in neighborhood mapping. This is a hand-drawn neighborhood map of an informal settlement that helps track migrants or access to different types of health care or presence of toilets in the house. These are informal settlement women groups doing data gathering using the red, yellow and green dots to denote different levels of risk for a particular indicator. For example, in this neighborhood, do most families not have toilets? So in that case, it would be red, or if it would be most families having toilet, it would be towards green, and if they feel the situation is somewhat in between, it would be yellow. This also helps them progress track. So if they have made efforts, they can see over the next 2 years whether a settlement has moved from red to yellow and is on the track to green. I'll share a few lessons which we have learned. Women's groups are very helpful, they are very powerful. So if groups are collectivized, they are able to take up a lot of work. And fortunately in India, the National Urban Health Policy has mandated formation of women's groups in informal settlements. The second method is community petitions for services. So these women's groups, they write petitions to the civic authorities, and they are gentle, non-confrontational. The purpose is to get the work done rather than to create a noise. And they are also polite and offer tea and biscuits when the executives from whichever department, they come to the neighborhood. You see a training session going on the left, and you see a petition writing going on the right picture. This is the scanned image of the petition with the signature of 15 to 20 community representatives and the telephone numbers of whoever are willing to give their phone numbers. On the left, women are making a request to an elected politician, elected ward representative, and here they are, on the right, they are submitting official petitions at the district public hearing, which is a formal accountability forum. Here they are improving access to voter ID, which lends greater legitimacy, and also the power to negotiate, because if they have voter IDs, they can negotiate better with the politicians. Women's empowerment reduces alcohol and gambling joints. It reduces early marriage, improves girl-child education. So it has many positive benefits. Here, all sectors come together because the work, the effort converges different sectors, different actors. And these are just glimpses of improvement. So over time, families have constructed toilets. So in the initial picture, you see a child defecating in the open, and there you see family members posing for their toilets in the lower row. Here you see crowding for water, and on the right, slightly improved water situation where a tank has been erected. The community is collectively purchasing water from this private tanker supplier during the acute summer crisis, which is again linked to climate change. This is garbage disposal to the truck where they have a segment for green waste and the other for the recyclable waste. Here it is self-explanatory. You see the street with garbage, and here is the clean street on the right. The same house which had water entered, and then slowly people are elevating the plinth of the houses in the picture on the right. These are still being constructed, but they are increasing the plinth gradually. The electricity connections which are dangerous on the left, and then on the right we see metered electricity connections. This picture is from Agra, the city of the Taj Mahal. After several years of effort, the community was able to convince themselves that they can grow vegetables despite living in informal settlements amidst dirt. Children not going to school, and on the right, slowly with motivation, more children going to school, including girl children. Children playing. They arrange their playground and play, which is natural and good for human development. Children performing in Mumbai. So on the left, the children are performing a play on the ills of alcoholism on a beach in Mumbai. For them, it's a huge confidence boost to go from Agra or from Indore and perform in Mumbai and then come back and share with their community that this is what they did. This is a drain. On the left upper picture, you see women and a child crossing the drain, and slowly through effort, the picture of 2015 shows that the authorities actually built a bridge on the drain. We have one person here who has seen this area. So this also tells you, and the other steps, that the government resources are actually, through this effort, reaching the informal settlements. Thank you very much.
we have time for questions, if possible, I would ask that you just identify yourself and say from the question, or if it's for the whole panel. We'll take three at a time just to start.
Hi, my name is Freddie. I'm a student at UCL VPU. My question is related to like why informal settlements don't have enough attention. I think that one of the issues right now is that the inhabitants are not really aware, or either unaware or either undermine the health risks of their environment. So one of the challenges of the government is actually to convince them that they need to improve the hygiene and sanitation in the areas, or they could also actually even move to the public housing that they provided, which they have lots to do because they already feel comfortable or where they are. So do you think that that is like one of the issues that we need to focus on?
We'll take three.
You're still thinking we could start with that one, I guess.
No, then there's
more. Apologies. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Derek from King's. It's just a question about how, for the three of you, how do you situate your work within the broader landscape of global health? So within the funding and politics. I was thinking particularly about David's talk. I think that it's not true that we don't know anything about health. I don't think it's true that there is no data or very little data. Many informal settlements are totally over-researched and brimming with data. But the problem is that many of the issues that we find do not sit very well with priorities in clinical health and funding tools. So many of the issues around social determinants of health are things that aren't funded at all, and also not of interest to municipal governments and not of interest to national and local governments. And so that is the more problematic disjunction. This disparity between a global health agenda and an urban sort of settlement agenda that you alluded to just a moment ago.
One more. Okay, for now, did you take any of those?
I'm happy to take either or both. It's a good point. The disparity between the kind of global health agendas and what's happening on the ground. And what saddens me is that all these big international funding agencies are set up basically to funnel money through national governments or for research through prestigious institutions. But if you look at Latin America, for instance, most of the improvements in urban health have been done by grassroots organizations, civil society, social movements, and local governments. And you had this wave of elected mayors with the return to democracy in so many countries. And that produced the local political context for much improved health and for responding to democratic pressures. Then you take all the amazing work done by the federations of slum dwellers, federations of shack dwellers. Despite the evidence that they've produced, despite the descriptions, it has had no influence on the global health. I don't know how you know, Bill and Melinda Gates visited a community toilet built in Pune. That was an absolute miracle. It had got negotiated the land, and they'd built a really nice toilet they were really proud of, that was well maintained, served men, served women, had a small meeting room. And all Bill Gates was doing was looking at the roof and saying, we could hire this space for mobile phone masts. He didn't get it. I don't know why. The institution makes it very difficult to deal with local issues. The whole UN process is with national government, national government, national government. How do we elevate, to me, the critical urban health issue, which is all around grassroots organizations and social movements and local governments that are accountable and democratic, and all that kind of local stuff, which is the only thing that will deliver the big global goals?
Yeah, I mean, I think the global health agenda hasn't addressed environmental issues much. And strangely, they seem to be waking up to the environmental change issues, which is kind of leapfrogging it. And there's also a capacity issue. You know, if you haven't got a lot of environmental health capacity, then it's quite hard to address some of these environmental change issues. And I'd agree with David that the global health, it's very infectious disease focused, it's very health intervention focused, and of course all the responses for dealing with these hazards, it's more around health and all policies, it's around planning and housing. So I'm cautiously optimistic that global health is changing and that they are kind of taking on this agenda in terms of topic. But then you have the institutional issues about whether funders will support research and partners who are within Summit, which is a separate issue.
Do you want to respond?
Yes, I just wanted to, and I think we've not responded to your questions. So what you said was that whether people in informal settlements are not aware of the social housing or not, are not willing to move to social housing. Well, in many countries there is no very well organized social housing, so that is one part of it. The other thing is that they often live in locations which also have their livelihood close to the location. And the housing may be, say, a 1 hour commute from where they actually live. So it may not be a very good mental fit for them to move to the other places. And if their families are also entrenched, the children would be going to schools which are probably a 10 to 12 minutes walk from that location. So there are several factors why informal settlement dwellers would not want to move from where they are located. And in many developing countries, the policy makers have understood and acknowledged, at least written on paper, about what is called in situ upgradation. So this is at least there on paper. It may not get implemented everywhere. And then responding to your question, I would compliment what Sari and David have said and take it from the perspective of a developing country where small organizations like ours, the civil society group, we do not have much expectation from the global policy agenda. And we know that for us, undertaking efforts is more crucial. For the underserved also, that effort is more crucial. So we do not wait for a big funding from anywhere, or whenever we get small to medium-sized funding, we try and utilize it in such a creative way that it continues to further the efforts of improving health. So what we do is that we operate our core at such low costs that that can continue without any large global aid. And we also avoid very narrow aid agency focus. For example, there are institutions that call me and they request that we should take up a project to improve immunization among children or family planning rates. And we avoid doing that because that would distract our team from the core work, which is foundational human capacity building. So that is how I think many other civil society organizations in different countries in the global south may be dealing with this challenge and will probably continue to do so in the future.
I mean, just Siddharth said it so well. When the savings groups formed by women who live in informal settlements can choose where they move to, and the terms under which they move, and the date they move, and with no violence and no organisation, they move because they've made choices about access to livelihoods, which, as Siddharth said, is so important. The other thing: go and look at where they got it wrong. On the periphery of Mexico City and in many other Mexican cities, there's tens of thousands of public housing units that were allocated to people living in central areas. Who they moved there, they found the quality was very poor, things were falling apart, the services were very poor quality, and the commute back to their own job was too high, so they abandoned them. You've got these enormous new areas of what from a distance looked like terraced houses that are really falling apart. if you don't understand the locational needs of low-income groups, then you'll completely fail them in their housing choices.
Should we move on to other questions?
So there must have been something you disagreed with.
My point is not just on public housing. I know that some governments actually failed to do so by not really thinking about the design aspect or the location aspect or the multidimensional mixed-use aspect. But one thing that I feel concerned about is that people in, aside from the good example in India, in where I come from, a lot of some rulers actually are not really aware that they're living in unhygienic or unsanitary conditions, that they don't really see that, you know, the fact they don't have a clean toilet is a problem. They just live with it. So because of the lack of education, and that's why they don't really bring their voice together. So.
Siddharth, I think you need to answer that.
So yes, you're right that wherever there is such lack of education and such lack of awareness, it does lead to this situation. And in the two cities that I mentioned where our organization has some effort, we also are able to serve only about 1/4 of Indore's informal settlement population and approximately 1/5 of Agra's urban settlement population. So even in those cities, you will find many other informal settlements which have not moved towards constructing toilets like the ones which I showed. So that is definitely true. But if somebody else, some other agency were to stimulate them, motivate them, I think their inherent wisdom is definitely there. They're not stupid people at all. It's just that somebody has to stimulate them with a listening approach rather than a telling approach. That's the difference which I think is very crucial.
In the back, please.
Yeah, my name is Lara. I'm from the University of Sheffield. I just want to say that perhaps we might need to situate this, global health agenda within the broader context of, the political economy of informal settlements. We did talk about, I came late actually, so I wouldn't know if some of these issues have been mentioned, but access to, for instance, waste disposal. You find that in most cases with informal settlements, there's exclusion. And you did mention, rather than telling, listening, it could come from misrecognition, particularly with informal settlements along the coast, because many of the people there have their livelihood tied to that place, and oftentimes they are not recognized as fishermen or fishermen. How do you take a fisherman into a social housing somewhere in the land and still expect them to have, that access? Then in terms of the waste management and waste disposal issue that is usually very, well known with informal settlements, to what extent, do they have access to the formal structures of waste disposal? A lot of time, many of this problem comes from exclusion. It comes from a misrecognition. And because a lot of the global funding will go to the national governments, and many of them, attribute causality for the problems within this settlement to the people. They are seen as they would rather offer humanitarian services when a disaster is likely to occur or when it has occurred than actually engage with them, because they have set the issue, they have placed the blame at their doorstep rather than, looking at broader issues that perhaps, say, for instance, their livelihood and other issues that have actually kept them there. It's just
thank you.
Hi, yes,
Catherine Ferdinand, ECL Institute for Global Prosperity. And this is for sort of an epidemiological question. So I've been working recently on a project on bovine tuberculosis in Ethiopia, and I was recently in Mekelle talking to sort of smallholder farmers, and they were talking lots and lots about the effects of climate change on animal health, and also on the effects of urbanisation on displacement, and then being given these very, very small plots of land for a short period of time. And it just really reminded me when you were saying about people's houses in Cape Town, they're having to build these temporary structures with iron sheeting, so they're just losing these cows that are worth, you know, 30,000 fur just to heat stroke. And basically, I was just wondering whether in your work you've sort of seen any, like, the effects in sort of zoonotic disease transmission and, you know, having all these animals sort of in urban centres with humans, whether you've seen any trends in that.
Just to answer that, so no, we wouldn't see trends, but there is a focus of interest, and I was going to mention it. So there's several drivers for emerging infections, and we've had Ebola, which had an urban focus, and Zika. So, you know, in terms of the global health agenda, looking at urbanisation as a facilitator for infectious disease and zoonosis, because you've got a lot of, you've also got bushmeat coming in, and you can get a lot of nasty things from eating bushmeat. And, you know, this kind of, any kind of new dynamic between, you know, the animal host and humans, it is a risk for a completely new pathogen to emerge, basically. So there is a lot of interest in that, and there has been some funding in that. In terms of trends, I don't know, but clearly it's got on the agenda, so the research agenda. Policy-wise, I don't know, because, you know, there are obviously wider things at work here about managing animals and people and stuff like that, but that kind of adds to the whole complexity of climate change. So, you know, there is an interaction between people having to move and changing their seasonal patterns that is very subtle, and I don't think there's been enough research on that sort of thing, especially moving between urban and rural. There's kind of a lot of anecdotal stuff about people not, if you can't plan to go back for certain seasons because the seasons are changing, that affects your, so there's a lot going on, and we really don't, as far as I know. I think it doesn't help. I think you have to be a little bit cautious about blaming. You know, sometimes it suits people to blame environment factors where it's political, and, you know, there's, I don't know enough about that. But clearly pastoralists are high risk for climate change in terms of the decades. It's really going to change. Climate change will change the risk of people's livelihoods, and their livelihoods are probably at risk in the long term.
Go back to political economy.
Sure. Do you want to start?
No.
One of the interesting things about informal settlements is some have 100% pipe water, sewers, drains, healthcare, schools, and some have none. And of course, it's quite difficult to talk in generalizations, but many informal settlements in Latin America, municipal authorities upgrade them as a kind of normal process of being a municipal government. It isn't seen as unusual. It was seen as unusual 25, 30 years ago, but now it's just something municipalities do. And they recognize the people living in informal settlements can be connected to water, piped water and sewers and electricity and all the infrastructure. Doesn't necessarily address the problems of very low incomes. As one woman said, you put a beautiful roof over my poverty. But at least these informal settlements, health conditions improve, security improves. Then you've got the places like in Thailand, largely through a national government agency, that national government actually supported people in informal settlements to organize and to come up with their solution, which they then funded. So you've got where governments do most of the delivery, governments support communities to do most of the delivery, and then at the other extreme where they're ignored or they're bulldozed and they're not seen as having the legitimate right to any public services. 30 years ago, most governments wouldn't have done this upgrading. Now maybe 15-20% do. The hope is that 15-20% expands to cover all the places where they're still being ignored or bulldozed. You don't get to eat and drink the wine until you've asked all the questions.
Hi, I'm Noan Dip. I'm also from UCL. And I'm doing my PhD on ecosystem services. And I was interested in knowing your opinion about the health benefits these can provide, especially in slums, and whether there are some risk group and limits to the implementation there.
You folks want to answer that? I think the trouble is, I think you'd give a better answer than we would.
Yeah.
This is obviously a subject you know well, and the three of us don't.
There's a lot of interest in urban green space, so, and kind of as a high income country. I guess ecosystem services in the kind of doesn't map very well to what we've been discussing today. And certainly within terms of zoonosis and infectious disease pathogens, which are largely negative on health, that framework doesn't fit at all. And I teach ecosystem services because we run an MSc in public health, and it's got no recognition at all within the kind of public health and environment and health field. So I can't think of anything. Apart from the green space, which basically this is urban parks and green infrastructure that has kind of amenity value and kind of a mental health benefit, it's kind of so far down the priority when you've got high burdens of diarrheal disease and, you know, 1 in 4 child mortality. I just think it won't get much traction at the moment.
Would you be saying that's because we don't have enough evidence of the links between infrastructure and improvement to help people with physical health, or is it because there is just no incentive?
Well, I think if you've got no infrastructure, you know, you have to prioritise your infrastructure, so, you know, water and sanitation, power, energy would be first, wouldn't they? And then transport. So the green infrastructure complex is kind of highly high income focused. That's about kind of parks and canal sites and lakes and things, isn't it? Whereas in a high density slum, I'm not sure they've got any space for parks. You know, the two agendas, you know, they obviously do overlap, and ecosystem services is also about food, and there's issues around urban footprints and you need how much ecosystem services you need to support our city as a whole. Do you see what I mean? But I don't think you'll get a lot of traction with the ecosystem services.
You've got watersheds that are hugely important for urban areas which have had encroachment, low-income groups going to build on them. And initially the assumption was you'd bulldoze them, but they were plenty of them, and they were politically organised. And so what they began to do is to look at how they could stay within a well-managed wetland.
Where was that?
That was around Sao Paulo, in and around the big reservoirs on which Sao Paulo draws so heavily.
That's a good example then. I couldn't think of one.
Maybe I can ask one question, then we can wind down. I was just going to ask.
Was somebody else wanting to ask a question?
Sorry, please.
This is certainly the politest panel discussion that we've run.
I just wondered about. The sort of when informed settlements have sort of infrastructure improvements, whatever they are, to how that you then ensure that low income community benefits from those, rather than that becoming a sort of more highly priced area. So if there's a disaster in the family, obviously there's a more valuable asset that they could sell and move to a poorer settlement, which means all of that's gone into kind of boosting the health credentials of that particular settlement, but that particular community might not see the long-term benefit because
they get priced out.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of gentrification, I guess, but I know in Brazil in the past there's been kind of the fact of doing the whole city meant that kind of nowhere was left behind as a kind of drain, but that's a very rare example.
Yeah. When you've got collective solutions which people have developed their housing together, they very often insist that everyone who lives there has got to live there 20 years. Or if they have to move, and there's good reasons for their moving, the house gets sold to the collective, and then so it doesn't become a process of gentrification. Now, that seems to work really well in Thailand. I don't know whether similar systems work elsewhere. They tried in India for the when the women pavement dwellers got to get formal housing. They chose to retain toilets shared by three households as a way of preventing gentrification. Another question at the back?
Yeah,
it was a question about where you think responsibility lies. So across the three talks there are slightly different narratives about where responsibility for improving urban health lies. So David, your talk seems to be very much more focused on the state and an obligation of the state to provide a municipality. Whereas by the third talk, there was a definite narrative of personal responsibility. So talk about all the motivation they managed to change this. But I just wondered if you could comment on where this responsibility lies, who should be making the changes? Should it be the grassroots? Should it be something that is state-led? And what about states, particularly poor countries, who are overwhelmingly dependent on external aids and agencies, NGOs, to provide even the most basic of state services, if they're provided at all? Where should this urban health agenda sit?
Mm. That's a good question. Can I say I don't have to answer that, because that's not my job? Just provide evidence. Whatever works is my answer.
You want me to? Okay. So, I think the responsibility lies in whoever wishes to be or decides to be sensitive about the disadvantaged. So just for a global group to say that we have a uniform system of the global agenda setters like the UN having this responsibility, the nation having this responsibility, and then provinces having separate responsibility, and cities and communities having separate responsibility. Our world is not so uniform to set a clear responsibility division for everyone. And there will be different levels of sensitivities among people who are driving a particular institution at different points in time. So there may be someone who's very sensitive towards the needs of the informal settlement dwellers in a particular country, in a particular entity, so they might be taking up greater responsibility. But on a procedural level, the country government does have substantial responsibility in the way the country is organized. For example, if it has a federal system, then the provinces or the states definitely have the responsibility, and then the city governments have the responsibility. The civil society and the grassroots organizing also have a responsibility, and often they have more serious sense of ownership about taking that responsibility with some sense of urgency. Because from the top, it might take several decades for a policy which has been articulated to actually trickle down. So therefore, traction from the grassroots, from the communities, with the help of civil society organizations, can help pull whatever is mandated in a particular policy, and there are resources allocated, either it is through the country's own resources or through the World Bank type of resources who provide loans or sometimes partial aid. Whichever way the resources come, somebody has to make the effort to pull that, because nobody sitting either in the World Bank or in the national country level, other than occasional people, will have the passion to take the responsibility to actually make things happen.
But it seems to me that in a country like India, the middle class would expect that the state provides certain services, but that people who live in informal settlements do not have that right to expect that the state provides the same services. You live in the same city. Why is it that one set of people have to mobilise around a grassroots organisation to lobby, lobby, lobby for incremental change, whereas for others, this is the norm? It's still the same state, so who should be responsible?
Yeah, I mean, so that is the inequalities which we are discussing. So there are these inequalities. The people in authority usually consider it more convenient to provide services to the middle class and usually ignore those who contribute to the economy itself, which is why the grassroots groups or civil society groups take up the onus on themselves. There could be some middle class residents welfare association or neighborhood association which also support this activity in certain parts of the world, but you know, we even within India we have very different types of situations in different parts. So you're right that the state considers it's easy to provide services to the middle class and ignores the lower income groups.
Can I make a comment on that?
Yeah.
When we started work in this field in 1977, we assumed that it was national governments making rational choices about policies supported by international agencies that would address all these problems. And of course, every year you got more and more, you knew you were wrong. You thought that these were natural allies, and they weren't natural allies. They weren't producing solutions. So if our commitment is to those with unmet needs, then in certain contexts you can look and see local government doing a pretty good job at that, and you would support any grassroots pressure to make sure it worked better. Where national government, local government are doing almost nothing for those with unmet needs, the only people we have responsibility to are those that are organizing within those to try and find new solutions for themselves. And you know, we're in a profoundly pessimistic profession in that so much goes wrong. But going to visit these federations, talking to the women, seeing how they organize, seeing how they manage, seeing the sophistication of their political economy analysis, you begin to realize that these are the people that we have responsibility to. And the last issue of the journal we publish, Environment and Urbanization, is on local funds for local groups. It's how you change financial support so that the people that have unmet needs get to control it, get to manage it, get to choose it, get to choose whose partners they work with, and to drive change. And of course, none of the federations think that they by themselves can generate all the needed change. They see themselves as government changers and international agency changers as well as local changers. The only nice thing too about feeling that you have responsibility to them is you watch in amazement how time after time they overcome enormous constraints for success. I suppose my dream is that, you know, there's about $160 billion going every year in overseas development assistance. Why can't we just allocate $1 billion of that to truly grassroots-led to community organizations and processes? I think it would transform development assistance. I think it would mean we could actually meet some of the SDGs.
I think we'll need to stop.
Maybe that
could
be the last.
We don't have time.
It's okay.
But thank you for coming, especially during a heat wave, to talk about climate change. I think we've had a really wonderful discussion around scale, on data shortfalls, on the challenges of situating urban within a broader agenda and the multiple scales that that would entail. We hope that this will be the start of bringing in non-health as well as health experts to a discussion on urban health equity with a focus on informal settlements, and to continue working hand in hand with communities as well as urban policymakers to support more meaningful health improvements. So with that, we will nourish you upstairs, and we thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
I don't know, it's